This is WebTalk Guys Radio, and thank you for listening today. And I'm Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana, and we are both here to give you another peek inside the future of the Internet. Every week, we do it on CNET Radio and over many other radio stations, both on and offline.
Today, we're going to try and get inside the head of Microsoft and its foray into the game console space with Xbox. Is the Xbox just another Microsoft experiment like Web TV that has kind of evolved into the MSN TV product? Or will it become the next Windows dynasty and find its way into the home and into the lives of millions of people around the world that really becomes a computer-like device that takes us all to a new high-speed access into online entertainment? With us today is Dean Takahashi, who's the author of Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution.
The long-term goal for Microsoft is to, one, hold off the PlayStation 2 from becoming the center of computing in the living room, and also to grab that position for Microsoft instead, and to establish this box in the home as the all things to consumers box.
Later in the show, we'll talk with Eric Schoenberg. Eric's the deputy editor of the magazine Business 2.0. The magazine's new list of 100 fastest-growing technology companies is on the cover of their October issue. We are going to find out who made the cut and why these companies are so hot, and how Business 2.0 has stayed on top in an economy where tech companies and magazines are falling all around them.
A lot of companies in the past few years destroyed their balance sheets, if not their cash flow statements, by merging and paying too much for companies. Stock investors did it. Companies did it, too. Among the B2100, you find very few companies that overspent on acquisitions.
All that ahead on WebTalk Guys Radio.
Some news from around the net this week. Web Marketing Association names 2002 Best Investment Website. And mobile PDAs will grow really big next year.
Frank Russell Company of Tacoma, Washington at www.russell.com has been named the best investment website for 2002 by Web Marketing Association. And it's the third straight year that russell.com has been honored by the association in the annual competition.
And they competed against 1,300 sites from 19 countries for this competition.
Dana, the mobile PDA market is going to grow big next year.
That's according to Instat MDR, which forecasts that handheld sales will sort of take on the mainstream in the consumer markets, which increases their growth.
The annual growth rate for the PDA market is going to be 17.6% for the year 2001 through 2006, and the highest growth rate is going to come next year.
About 19% of PDAs right now have access to the Internet, but that's going to grow so that by year 2006, almost all of them, 70%, will get you online. We received an audio email from Ian Patterson, who heard Web Talk Guys from his home in Dunedin, New Zealand. Ian used an audio service from www.wimba.com to send us his thoughts on the show with his own voice. And we were so pleased to get that, Ian, that we wanted to get your permission to air it, and we have it for you right now.
Hello there. I would just like to express my appreciation and admiration of your very interesting shows. One particular I've just listened to was the interview on designing web pages, 50 websites deconstructed with Marie Tahir. That was a fascinating 42 minutes and seemed to cover everything one would want to know about sensible design of websites, briefly but to the point. And that's just an amazing sort of thing one can get free on the internet, along with many other things on your show. I must say I liked your show mainly perhaps because of Rod Greenlee's gentle, unhurried but authoritative delivery. He is just a pleasure to listen to. I have to say on the actual interview I've listened to that Dana's voice seemed somehow muffled. Rod's was excellent and clear. And your guest, Marie Tahir, spoke very clearly too, although I rather felt the volume for her may have been a little higher than for the other two of you, which made my life a little difficult because there's someone asleep in the next room. Anyway, I just must thank you for your wonderful work, and good luck to you from New Zealand.
Thanks, Ian. We know that from your emails and the log files that come to our website and those of you that have signed up for our newsletter that we have listeners from all over the world. And we're really thrilled to hear from Ian in New Zealand. And we want to make this promise to you. Send us your thoughts about the internet, whether it's how you use it or anything you have to say about the internet, and voice it to us. Send it via an MP3 file. You can use Ian's method at wimba.com or one of your own choosing, and we'll do our best to get your voice on the air.
Last week, we shared some audio blogs, which had such a great response that we want to continue adding as many voices as we can to our show, just like what Dana asks of you. But audio blogs is certainly a terrific way to communicate with us. You can post it to your website, or you can send it to us, and we'd be happy to air it on the show. And you can just send it to us via email, or just like what Dana said, use the wimba.com website, and all you need is a microphone and a web browser. And we'd like to invite everyone to email us your audio message, or just a text message, send it to robg@webtalkguys.com or dana@webtalkguys.com.
Now stay connected for a special conversation with Dean Takahashi, who's the author of Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution.
You don't want to miss that.
This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
You're back listening to Web.Guys Radio, and thank you for joining us again today. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Webgirl Dana. Well, whenever I think about Microsoft, I think about how clever they are to jump into a market at just the precise time. I mean, after the other companies have sort of laid the groundwork and the industry is just starting to emerge, I mean, think about the browser wars and about streaming media. And now think about the video game industry, which is one of the fastest growing markets today.
Microsoft wanted to be in the gaming industry and has put billions of dollars on the line to build their own video game console, the Xbox. So we've invited Dean Takahashi to join us today on the show to get his take on Microsoft's gamble with the Xbox. Dean is the author of Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. Dean has also been a business journalist for the past 14 years and currently writes for the San Jose Mercury News and is a former senior writer for the Red Herring magazine, as well as the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, and has appeared on CNN and CNBC. Not only is Dean a journalist and a gaming industry expert, but he's also a diehard video gamer. Dean, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
Hey, your book that you wrote out there, it talks about the Xbox and Microsoft's plan and kind of the entertainment revolution that they're trying to do here. Can you explain a little bit of the background of the book?
Yeah, there are four different levels of story in the book. One is about how the game industry is graduating from a sort of a cult into a mainstream status, moving from sort of a lack of respect to becoming more of an art form. And that was some of the original motivation behind the guys who proposed doing the Xbox at Microsoft. They felt like the industry had arrived and it was time for Microsoft to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then another level of story was the fighting going on between the superpowers of the industry, Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was also another level of contention within Microsoft where the Xbox team had to justify itself and square off against the web TV people and the PC advocates as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of the glue of the story on sort of the most basic level was this inner conflict within Seamus Blackley, the co-founder of the Xbox, and his need to sort of remake his identity in the wake of failing miserably with one of his ideas for a great game. You know, he crashed and burned on his game, and then he decided, I'm going to go hide out at Microsoft and just sort of do some good old-fashioned programming, and then he came upon this idea to outdo Sony and the PlayStation 2.
How is the Xbox doing out there right now, from what you're hearing?
Well, it did very well in the U.S. when it launched. It sold 1.5 million units in the first 6 weeks, and the problem was that it sort of fell flat in Japan, and it was overpriced at the outset in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this sort of reflects, you know, both of what Microsoft's good at and what it's weak at.
Mm-hmm.
And it did a very good job stoking the technology fiends in the U.S., but in the Japanese market, it had a very big problem trying to overcome the Nintendo and Sony brand names.
Sure, I can see that that could happen. Do you see the Xbox being a success? Microsoft's put a lot of money in this and a lot of hope that it's kind of going to become the next Windows. What's your thoughts at this point?
In a lot of respects, it is meeting their goals. The goals that they outlined at the beginning were to get into the business and to have something that was close to being sustainable on its own. They still have a ways to go before they're going to make any money. Right. And in fact, the current estimate is that they may lose $1 billion on the Xbox in the current fiscal year. And they had just come off a year where they lost $750 million on the launch of the Xbox.
Wow.
But that's peanuts to Microsoft. You know, it's got $37 billion in cash or so. And if they never made another dime, you know, this Xbox business would drive them out of business in 37 years. So they got a cash advantage. Sony also has quite a pile of cash, not as much as Microsoft. But the long-term goal for Microsoft is to, one, hold off the PlayStation 2 from becoming the center of computing in the living room, and also to grab that position for Microsoft instead, and to establish this box in the home as the all things to consumers box that will connect online, basically be a computer, and, you know, over time, they would expect that to have this relationship with the with tens of millions of the most ardent consumers of technology is going to pay off for them in some way, either in e-commerce or subscriptions to online games or whatever. But eventually it's going to make them a boatload of money.
So what you're saying is that Microsoft's thinking that the office computer, the actual desktop, will remain there, and what they're seeing is the living room as the new opportunity that they have to expand their platform?
Yes, exactly. And in their own language, they called it the twin pillars of the home.
Oh, I see. What type of applications do you see them really deploying on that platform over time? Now, games obviously is the one that they're doing right now, but what is kind of the bigger strategy there?
It has also has a DVD movie playing right now. You buy a $30 attachment and you can watch movies. Over time, when they do the next remake of the Xbox, which could happen either sooner in sort of like a 1.5 version edition, or maybe a Xbox 2 coming in 2005, the most likely option is they will expand that hard drive that's already in there and make use of it to record TV shows. So to make it into a TiVo machine.
TiVo-type machine, sure.
Where it's digitally recording shows onto a hard drive. There are some problems with adding more and more capabilities into the machine, and that is you always sort of have that possibility that you're going to lose sight of the original market, the gamers. And you put something in there that they don't want. And one example here could be that if the hard drive is being used by a game and that game needs to run, you know, take full 100% control of the power of that machine, when you've got a, you know, pre-recorded point for recording a TV show and it starts using the hard drive to record that TV show,
it's going to pull
resources.
What happens
to the game? Yeah. Does it slow down the game? It's possible to do this, but it's a matter of figuring out the multitasking software that makes use of the hard drive simultaneously.
So obviously their strategy does involve some sort of broadband access. And how does that change the equation?
Competitively, it's an interesting picture because Sony has a 56K modem capability that they are including with adapters. Sony was betting that broadband was going to take off slowly and that they had to take care of their customers through modems in the meantime. Microsoft bet only on broadband. The Ethernet connection is the only port on the machine. The reason they did that was a couple of what they did think in 1999 when they were designing this that broadband would be fairly ubiquitous by now, especially among gamers. And part of that is true. Maybe 50% of the people who bought Xboxes have broadband. The other notion was that it would sort of raise the target for game developers to develop better high quality games that make use of broadband and didn't rely on 56K as their sort of lowest common denominator. So they would get better games out of it, a better playing experience, and include new capabilities, you know, on a baseline like voice communications over the internet.
Now, Dean, you are a journalist and you're a business journalist, which means, of course, you do study Microsoft's strategies and business. But your book, Opening the Xbox, also sort of tells the story of the drama. And you mentioned earlier the sort of infighting between the Xbox people and the web TV people, and there's the streaming media, the Windows Media Division. I mean, can you give us a little hint of sort of the... Is Microsoft such a bureaucracy that the divisions fight amongst each other?
There is this danger in any large company that you strangle the new business because it can't justify itself right off the bat. You know, mm-hmm. You've got this great Windows monopoly, and what's the point of going into a business where you're going to lose money for maybe 5 years or more? Is that a good use of your cash? And I guess the way the top brass looked at it was, you know, well, in order to sustain growth in the future, we need to enter large new businesses. And the video games business was looking pretty large at $20 billion a year. I mean, there aren't that many large markets that Microsoft could very suddenly or quickly move into. But, yeah, the guys on the lowest level had a very hard time trying to convince people that they needed to move really fast. And in the early days, it mattered a great deal. They lost a lot of time as they debated between divisions. You know, should we go with a web TV-like machine or should we go with a very PC-like Xbox? And no secret that, you know, they came out with the machine 18 months after the PlayStation 2 debuted. When one of the original things they were thinking about in 1999 was to come out at the same time as Microsoft. And Sony has sold 40 million PlayStation 2s, and the Xbox at last count was 4 million, and it's probably somewhere above that by now, mm-hmm. maybe 6 million. That lost time is something that they're never going to get back.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So is the Windows Media Series 9 going to figure in this Xbox at some point for online streaming of video and those type of sources online?
There's parts of the machine that still would have to be made much more secure if the end goal of putting Windows Media 9 on a machine is to be realized. And I would think the end goal is to convince Hollywood that this is a box that it's okay to stream movies to. Uh-huh. Or music, too. And right now, the PC itself is not a very secure box, in contrast to very secure set-top boxes that mm-hmm. the cable companies and the satellite TV companies produce. You know, at any sort of point of communication within the PC, you can listen in to what's going on and copy that data to somewhere else. And so copying is a technology that Hollywood just tends to hate.
I don't like that at all.
Yeah, and the Xbox is built on PC technology, so it would have to incorporate a lot more better encryption in order to satisfy Hollywood and to make that Windows Media 9 into something that's very useful.
We're talking with Dean Takahashi, a writer for the San Jose Mercury News, and the author of Opening the Xbox is giving us a look inside of Microsoft's plan as they rolled out their game console. We have to take a quick break, but we'll be back with Dean and more on Microsoft in just a moment. This is Web Talk Eyes Radio.
Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm here with Web Girl Dana.
And Dean Takahashi is on the line with us. He wrote the book Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. And he's giving us the lowdown on Microsoft's new game console.
Do you see the Xbox supporting wireless transfers through a broadband type connection? Because I know a lot of people have wireless networks at home, but they may not have a cable that's over there by the television set.
Yeah, I believe that the Ethernet port in the back should be able to support a 802.11 wireless mm-hmm. you know, converter, so that the Xbox itself does not necessarily need to be plugged into the broadband connection, and that maybe you can share it from
okay.
the PC.
Oh, that's
true. But I've yet to see that kind of attachment out there. I think in the home also, another vision that Microsoft has is something called eHome, and that was to attach the wireless capability onto a PC, then be able to detach things like the monitor, you know, mm-hmm. and carry it around with you in the rest of the home, and to use the wireless capability to connect the PC to the rest of the consumer electronics gadgets in the home.
Yeah.
And they're moving forward on that vision, and the first products on that, the media Media Center edition of Windows XP is going to be hitting this fall. That's sort of the other thrust in the living room that, as they move forward with the Xbox, they're also trying to make the PC more consumer electronics friendly.
Oh, okay. So they're kind of blending the media between the desktop as well as the Xbox, right?
Right.
I mean, it almost seems like they're trying to roll out more on the desktop right now than they are on the Xbox. Would that be a true statement?
Yeah, and I think it's probably a little easier to introduce new technologies onto the PC as a platform than it is to get the cable companies to do things like revise their set-top boxes and to get those new set-top boxes into homes. So there's sort of an advantage that Microsoft has in being able to expand a PC platform quickly. The Xbox, on the other hand, expandability isn't necessarily that big an option there until they introduce the next version in 2005 or so.
Oh, I see.
Dean, just to set aside the business and the technology of the game console for a moment, let's take a look inside your living room, because I was amused to read that, as well as being a hardcore journalist, you're a hardcore gamer.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know, just give us a little side of your personality. What do you love to play?
I'm often the niche of gamers that likes war games. You know, I'm a history buff. Right now I'm playing a game from Electronic Arts called Battlefield 1942 on my PC. I'm having a lot of fun charging up and down Omaha Beach.
The beach, yeah. So now you're using your PC to play games, and do you use a console as well?
Well, by now I was sort of expecting to be playing a lot more console games than I am, but yet the PC holds a lot of attraction still. The biggest game coming from Microsoft this fall is Age of Mythology, and it's an outstanding PC game. There's nothing that's coming on the Xbox that's going to probably take me away from that game. So in some ways I'm disappointed that I have not been completely converted by Xbox games or the other console games.
Do you play in moderation, or are you an all-nighter?
A couple hours a day at the most, so I have other duties in the household.
I understand.
Certainly your thoughts on playing, it sounds like you're playing a lot more games on your desktop, probably boils back to computing power. Do you see that as one thing that's really holding back the Xbox? Is it doesn't have a P4 in it with 2 gig or something like that that can really drive a real immersive experience?
Well, I think the Xbox has people have not really tapped the potential of the Xbox yet. And one thing that's interesting is that id Software, the maker of the Doom games, says that Doom 3, you know, it's coming out first on the PC, and it's going to look very good on the high-end PC that has, you know, probably twice as good graphics and processing power as the Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they also say that Doom 3 will be fairly easy for them to convert to run on the Xbox. They're going to do that next year. But Doom 3 will not run on a PlayStation 2, or it won't run on a Nintendo GameCube.
Oh, really?
They just can't down-res it enough, I guess, to get it to run on those machines.
So what's your thought on who's going to win these game console wars here that are being put out there between Nintendo, Sony, and Microsoft? I mean, who's going to be standing on top of the hill in the end?
Sony will be standing on top of the hill in 2005.
Okay.
And that's will be the end of this round. But the next round, everybody's going to be much closer to starting at the same starting line.
Okay.
And, you know, Xbox will not be 18 months behind the next PlayStation.
And when you say the next round, I mean, you're saying not just the new consoles, but the new features on those consoles, like you were mentioning before.
Yeah. Yeah, PlayStation 3 seems to be targeted for arrival around 2005.
Right? Okay. Oh, I see.
And Microsoft won't be late.
They better not be, right?
Yeah.
We're in the middle of a conversation with Dean Takahashi, who wrote the book Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. More in a moment with Dean. This is Web Talk Guys Radio. The Web Talk Guys are thrilled to be your radio hosts, but we'd also be thrilled to host your website, too. The WebTalkGuys website hosting service combines a high-speed, dedicated internet connection and the marketing power of a link from the show's website to help you. We offer all the standard hosting stuff for a very low, limited-time hosting price of only $10 a month for the first 3 months. To learn more, go to WebTalkGuys.com and click on Web Services or email info@WebTalkGuys.com. You can reach us by calling area code 253-640-0164. WebTalkGuys, not just your radio hosts, but also your total hosting solution.
911 emergency response.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, get in there, talk about www.com, and you got them naked chicks on there, man, you go click, 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 it's real easy, man.
It's Web Talk Guys Radio. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. We're having a conversation with Dean Takahashi. He's joining us to talk about his book, Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution.
Well, now let's talk a little bit more about the future of gaming and kind of get your perspectives on that and how things are going to evolve from a user's experience standpoint. I know we're starting to see more games come out that are virtual reality. I know I've seen some football games that have come out that look almost like you're watching Monday Night Football. What's the next step here? Are we going to be putting on VR head glasses at some point and actually getting into the game?
Well, before we get there, there are some very good games that are coming for things like the Xbox. Next year, there's a game called Project Ego coming from a developer named Peter Molyneux at Lionhead Studios that is doing a role-playing game where the character that you create can actually have a sort of a total impact on changing the world in the game. By that, I mean, if he, while he's young, say he chops down a tree in the middle of a forest, he can come back to that game 20 years later where he's aged by 20 years as a character, but he will find that stump where he chopped down that tree. And the world will be completely malleable in that sense. And that's sort of like a very ambitious undertaking. And there are other games coming out this fall that are online games for the consoles. Sony launched their network adapter to make online games possible on the PlayStation 2 in August. And there's a U.S. Navy SEALs game that's out where you can play multiplayer against other people. Mm-hmm. The broadband-only Xbox Live online game service will launch in November. And it'll have some games like Unreal, which is very popular on the PC. Next year, there's going to be an online version of Halo, which was Microsoft's smash hit for the Xbox from last year. And those games are going to look prettier and prettier on the graphics. Reflections, sunshine, outdoor environments, immersive animations. Mm-hmm. So it's going to get better and better for sure. I don't know when it gets to the Star Trek holodeck.
The actual holodeck, that's the holy grail of what I'm talking about, I guess. And,
yeah.
And is that on the horizon, do you think?
I think when Sony dropped the hint about what was going to be the processing power of the PlayStation 3, you could tell that they're aiming for that. They want to have always on online connected worlds that people can jump into at any time very easily. And it would make use of an architecture which they say would be 1,000 times faster than the processing power of the PlayStation 2.
Wow.
And it would do so by commandeering processing power over broadband connections from other devices, you know, either in the home or someplace else, where it could take processing power that's available and apply it to the game that is running on the PlayStation 3.
Actually, Dean, you've definitely studied all consoles out there, and if you could just go ahead and put on your testimonial hat right now and talk to the people that are listening, and when I say people, I mean myself, who wants to buy a console and just doesn't know which one. What's your recommendation?
I would say you're going to have a much broader selection of titles and also some exclusive titles on Sony and the PlayStation 2. They won't necessarily look as pretty as what they look like on the Xbox. So if you like graphics, then maybe Xbox is something that's worth investing in for you. But if you want a wide variety of games, it's sort of like that PC versus Apple argument.
You've been very fair-minded, except for poor Nintendo. They didn't get mentioned. Dean, tell us what's coming up for you and a little bit about where we can find your book.
I have a panel discussion on whether games are going to be bigger than movies at some point, coming up at the Churchill Club, which is going to be a panel discussion from 6 to 8 p.m. on October 23rd at Hyatt Ricky's in Palo Alto. And then the book is opening the Xbox, and it's available in bookstores now and on Amazon.
Much success. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you very much.
It was great having you on the show.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
We've been speaking with Dean Takahashi, who's the author of a book called Opening the Xbox, Inside Microsoft's Plan to Unleash an Entertainment Revolution. And he's also a staff writer at San Jose Mercury News, and he writes about technology. And if you're interested in finding his book, you can find it at www.primapublishing.com. That's P-R-I-M-A publishing.com, or you can just go to amazon.com and type in Opening the Xbox and you'll find his book.
Now stay plugged into the Web Talk, guys, because coming up next, we'll have a look at the 100 fastest growing technology companies from a new list published in the magazine Business 2.0. Joining us today, Eric Schoenberg, who's the deputy editor of Business 2.0, to talk about what makes these companies so successful during these shaky times. You're listening to Web Talk, guys, radio.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
I'm interested in upgrading my 28.8 kilobaud internet connection to a 1.5 megabit fiber optic T1 line. Will you be able to provide an IP router that's compatible with my token ring Ethernet LAN configuration?
Can I have some money now?
As listeners to the Web Talk Guys radio show, I'm sure you're aware that companies that have an internet presence have in turn a great marketing strategy. Web Talk Guys website design service builds terrific business websites. Whether you're seeking a basic website or a revamp of your existing site, or maybe just someone to make periodic updates on your website, the Web Talk Guys website design service can assist you in developing a great face on the web. To learn more about the Web Talk Guys website design service special offer on site design or hosting, go to webtalkguys.com, click on Web Services, email us at info@webtalkguys.com, or you can give us a call at area code 253-640-0164. Web Talk Guys, not just radio guys, but also your total website solution.
And now, the internet's future. The Web Talk Guys.
This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and thanks for joining us again. My name is Rob Greenley.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. The October issue of the magazine Business 2.0 featured a cover story on the editor's new list of 100 fastest-growing technology companies. We wanted to find out who made that cut and why these companies are doing okay during the shaky tech economy.
Here to talk about the list is Eric Schoenberg, who's the deputy editor for Business 2.0. Eric has been the assistant managing editor for Fortune magazine and has spent 13 years at Money magazine. Eric also broadcasts a radio program called You and Your Money and is a contributor to Public Radio's Marketplace. He is also the author of 401k, Take Charge of Your Future. Eric, thanks for coming on the show with us today.
My pleasure. Nice to be here, Rob.
Hey, why don't you tell us about this Business 2.0 top 100 list of the fastest growing tech companies and what kind of drove you guys to come out with that list this year?
Well, we set out to find the fastest growing companies, but we wanted to define that in our own way. I mean, it figures that even in a recession as horrible as this one has been for tech companies, there's some companies that are still outstanding and still growing by the numbers we all got so accustomed to in the late 90s. And sure enough, those companies are there. One thing that complicated this whole endeavor, though, was that some of the earnings numbers that companies have been reporting over the past 2 years aren't exactly reliable.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
We looked at a number of different criteria, not just earnings, to make sure that we were looking at companies that really had performed well in what turned out to be a terrible market. So we looked not just at earnings, but also at revenues and very heavily at cash flow. That's a very hard thing for people who are inclined to manipulate numbers to really fool around with. You can't mess with cash so much. And also, as a kind of crystal ball into the future, we also looked at their stock price performance. And obviously, stock prices doesn't always predict the future, but it is a place where people are betting their own money on a company's forward prospects. So we wanted to see companies as well that had good stock returns.
Let's talk a little bit more about cash flow and why you guys use that as criteria. It seems like that's an unusual criteria to use.
Well, operating cash flow basically is the amount of cash that's left over at the end of the year, and the money that comes from the operations the company actually performs. You know, it takes away things like goodwill, amortization, and all those other things that can mess around with earnings numbers. So it really is a measure of the company's health, and it gives you a sense of how the company's doing right now.
Well, that certainly makes sense. What were the top five companies, actually, that came out of this survey?
Number one was Logitech International. They are the world's largest maker of computer peripherals. Now, why would a company that makes peripherals for the PC industry, which is very sick, among the best performers? Well, there are a number of reasons. One of them is that they are, as the CEO puts it, they're in the gasoline selling business. And they make money whether people buy new cars or not.
Yeah.
You're much more likely to upgrade with a nice $80 optical cordless mouse than you are to go out and buy a $3,000 PC system. Another thing about their business is they have been very attentive to cash flow, cutting costs, making sure that they control inventory very well, and that shows up in the bottom line of the cash flow statement.
The number two company, it's a company in California, it looks like, also.
California Amplifier is a company that makes broadband transceivers, so it's been benefiting a lot from the satellite TV boom. It had to restate 2000 earnings, one of the endemic problems of companies in the past few years, that even after that restatement, it still has the combination of great cash flow growth and earnings growth and stock performance that made it number two on our list.
Number three, I think everybody knows eBay, but...
Right. Well, we're glad to see a large company make the list. eBay has a terrific niche, and a niche that's proving to be pretty much recession-proof. After all, where are you going to shop when you're running low on cash, but in a flea market, and eBay is the world's biggest.
Does longevity factor into any of these companies? In other words, ones that have been around, I know in the tech industry it's hard to say what's longevity, but do you think that those that are more stable, like maybe Logitech, have proven over years that they deserve to be in that spot?
We set a hurdle pretty high for this industry. You had to be around for 3 years. You had to have positive earnings and cash flow growth for at least a couple of those years. And you had to be above $50 million in sales. So we eliminated, just by those hurdles, a lot of the companies that might be flashes in the pan.
So is this a one-time list for you guys, or are you guys going to do this every year?
No, I'd like to come back to it year after year. The companies that are at the top of the B2 100 list give you a snapshot of what's really working in technology right now.
Well, I wondered if this is part of your brainchild, since your pedigree, your history has been with Fortune Magazine, Money Magazine. They're all well-known for their top lists. So is that something that you thought of?
Yes. Yes, it was, and something that I shepherded. I had the Fortune fastest-growing list to key off, although we made it very much our own by focusing on technology companies, by emphasizing cash flow in a way that Fortune does not.
Eric, why don't you run down some of the others in the top 100 that particularly stand out in your mind that you think are interesting success stories?
Number four, I think, is a very interesting company, too. It's Activision. It's the number two publisher of video games. And among its recent wins in the licensing business, the Spider-Man movie, Stuart Little, X-Men, Toy Story. Like computer peripherals, computer games is one place that's been a haven in the tech tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why this company's done so well. Number eight on the list is White Electronics, and this is an illustration of another place that people, even in the worst tech recession in memory, can still make money, and that isn't selling stuff to the government. Now, White's specialty is that they make custom-made packages of processors and memory that can take more abuse than ordinary manufacturers. They come in hardened package, and there are what they call ruggedized. It's just the sort of thing you want to give to soldiers who are going to put it in their Humvee and take it out in Afghanistan or out in the field somewhere.
One thing that really jumped out at me about your list is that there are very, very few companies that are primary online companies, like an Amazon.com or those type of players. I mean, eBay is the only one on the list that would qualify, I would think, as an online company.
Well, eBay is unusual for a lot of online companies in that it's profitable and has been for a long time. And they're expanding beyond the flea market model to become a liquidator for companies or another retail outlet for large vendors like IBM.
You guys also run down a list of the seven secrets of success when it comes to a tech company in this kind of an economy. Could you run down through a few of those?
I'd be happy to. One of the things about this list that we hoped would happen was that you were able to take a look at the 100 and figure out why they ended up among the fastest growing companies and distill from that the kinds of things they did that could be lessons to other companies in what makes you successful even in a stormy economy. The number one thing we found was focus. Find out what you do well and keep at that. That certainly would apply to Logitech with its focus on computer peripherals. Daktronix was a very successful company breaking into the electronic scoreboard business because it produced a better screen than Panasonic and Mitsubishi and Sony, which had previously dominated that market.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing would be to keep an eye on costs. One example that we drew from our list was Roper Industries, number 60 on the list, whose chairman didn't want to spend the money to be photographed for the annual report.
Oh, really?
I love it.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to save too much money, though.
No, but it shows the penny-pinching philosophy of that company.
Well, I can understand.
It's symbolic, yeah.
Innovation is a key. Again, to go back to the example of Logitech, our number one company, they are producing new products in a very steady stream, and that's allowed them to get ahead of a lot of trends.
That's also an expensive thing for a company to do, too, if they're always pumping in money into R&D and things.
Well, that's right. I think that you'd find, though, that the successful companies are companies that continue to spend on R&D when in a market like this. That positions them better for when the upturn finally comes.
Exactly. That's true.
A lot of companies in the past few years destroyed their balance sheets, if not their cash flow statements, by merging and paying too much for companies. Stock investors did it. Companies did it, too. Among the B200, you find very few companies that overspent on acquisitions. In fact, some of the acquisitions turned out to be very shrewd. Fiserv, for example, which is our number 28, it's a company that handles technology for retail banks, credit unions, brokerages, and things like that. It's made more than 100 acquisitions over the past 18 years, but none of them were branching into brand new businesses or trying to expand its footprint in that way. All of those companies were sort of incremental additions to its portfolio of capabilities, and it sort of incrementally improved what Fiserv could do for its clients.
Seems like in the current economy, it would be a prime market for companies to go out and acquire other companies right now because their valuations are so low.
Well, that's right. This would be the time to do it,
yeah,
not
I
in
mean,
1999.
So are we seeing companies go out and do that? I haven't heard a lot of that going on, and I don't know if it's just because there's not a lot of cash available to do that.
Well, I think that's right. There are lots of bargains out there, but no one has the money to spend on it.
Yeah.
You certainly can't go into the equity market and raise money by issuing new stock to people because the stock market is still punch drunk.
And, you're not going to get any money out of doing that, yeah.
Lenders are very reluctant to lend on anything to do with technology. So it's frustrating. The bargains are there, but the capital can't be had.
So would you say that most of the companies on the list are publicly traded companies?
All the companies are publicly traded.
That's probably how you were able to get so much data on them.
That's right.
A person can really use that list is probably a good gauge for looking at companies if they want to invest in them over the next year or something like that.
I think that it's a great research tool for investors. I would caution investors that this is a backward-looking snapshot of the way business has been over the past 3 years, and it doesn't mean that a company that has done well by our ranking system over the past 3 years will do well in the future.
Sure.
But as an indication of how a company operates and whether it has been hitting the sweet spot in the recent market, I think there's no better way to figure it out.
Let's take a look at Business 2.0 as a magazine just for a moment. Now, you obviously have a website, probably have had it since inception.
Oh, yes.
How important is the website to the company and the magazine in general? I know you put the articles up after the issue's been on the newsstands for a while.
Well, it's very important to us. I mean, this is our business. This is the field we cover. The Internet is, just such an important medium for that. It allows us to do things, the stories that we couldn't possibly do in the magazine. The B2100 is a great example because when you look up the B2100 on the website, you can rearrange the list, you can reorder it, not by the combined criteria that we used, but you can find out the top 10 companies by sales or the top 10 by cash flow growth or the top 10 by earnings or by stock market performance, however you want to cut it.
We're talking with Eric Schoenberg. He's the deputy editor of the magazine Business 2.0 on the web at business2.com. And he's giving us the scoop on the 100 fastest growing technology companies in the October issue of their magazine. More in a moment. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
You are listening to the Web Talk Guys.
Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm here with Web Girl Dana.
And we have Eric Schoenberg with us today. Eric's the deputy editor of the magazine Business 2.0. He's telling us about the new list in the October issue of the 100 fastest growing technology companies.
So how has Business 2.0 been able to survive when so many other magazine publishing companies has had a hard time over the last couple of years?
Well, Business 2.0 has a rich parent. That doesn't
hurt.
That
certainly helps. Cash flow, right?
Yeah. We are owned by Time Warner, and we're in the same family with such estimable business publications as Fortune and Money. That's where we draw a lot of our heritage as well as our cash. Our parent is very happy to have a West Coast technology-based business magazine. As my boss, John Huey, said, it's very healthy to have a West Coast perspective on the world of business. We aren't focused entirely on technology, but we do have a different way of looking at things that's less driven by Wall Street and more driven by an interest in different ways of doing things in business that Eastern-based magazines just don't have an angle on.
Yeah, it certainly seems like you guys transitioned from being kind of an online-focused topic publication to more general business. And would you say that that was really the core reason why you guys are still around today?
I think so, but I think that it was always our mission. You know, in the early years of B2100's history, remember there was a management change about a year ago when the old Business 2.0 was taken over by Time Warner and people from Fortune and Time put in management positions. But since that point, you know, we're a magazine about business, and the intersection of business and technology is kind of the sweet spot of our mandate.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But we're certainly not meant to be a technology handbook or a trade magazine. If I may, let me just give you a run-through of what's coming up in the November issue and give you an idea of the breadth of stories.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That we cover.
Sure.
Our cover story is a story about how to make decisions instinctively. Now, everyone can tell stories about some great business decisions that were made strictly from the gut without any help from research and in spite of the best wisdom of all the talking heads, Fred Smith starting FedEx or the beginning of Starbucks or things that people could have told you wouldn't have worked, and yet the founders knew in their gut that it would. There is now a great deal of scientific research that suggests why it is that great decisions come from the gut. And scientists are saying that whatever you want to call it, instinct, sixth sense, gut thinking, that is a much better way of thinking, of perceiving what's going on than people give it credit for.
Yeah, I think a lot of the business schools focus on research. You know, it's almost like market research is what drives what a company does from a marketing perspective.
And yeah, that's right. It's gather the data, analyze the data, make a decision tree based on the data. But really, that doesn't always lead you to the best decision. There are things that you know in your gut that the data doesn't tell you.
But certain people have better intuition than others.
Well, that's right, but it's also true that it's wrong to think of it as a talent or a gift. It's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And like any skill, you can improve it, and you can train yourself to be a better gut thinker. And our story tells you how to do that. Another story is about a scandal that was much wider than anyone realized in business. You've heard about Enron and Tyco and so forth, but just about every large company, 75%, were making loans to insiders, a practice that is now against the law, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that could come back to haunt some of the biggest names, from Microsoft to WorldCom. We've heard about Bear Stearns, Conseco. These are all companies which lent millions of dollars to their executives and, in many cases, then forgave those loans.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the online bust that we just went through. And I know as we look back, it seems like the internet bust was the catalyst that created the initial downturn in our economy. Recently, we were starting to see a little life come back. And it seems like with the accounting scandals and the terrorism and just one thing after another, we've plummeted down even more. Do you think that the internet and web business growth that actually took us down initially will be one of the first things that we see start to roar back?
I'm not sure. The collapse of the web businesses was, in many cases, long overdue. There were companies whose business models simply didn't work, and it was a leading indicator. The process by which the web has become so insinuated into our lives will not go away, and in fact is proving itself during this recession as a way to do many things more efficiently than they can be done otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that this recession has caused tech spending to collapse and cause CFOs to scrutinize every cost, that's been to the benefit, I think, of certain kinds of web businesses that can do things more cheaply than other ways.
You bet. It's been great having you on the show.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us, and we've been speaking with Eric Schoenberg, who's the deputy editor of the Business 2.0 magazine, and we've been talking about the cover story on the October issue of the 100 Fastest Growing Technology Companies, and you can certainly find his magazine at business2.com. Thank you, Eric.
Rob, my pleasure.
And I hope you have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
This is Web.Guys Radio.
And I'm Webgirl Dana.
And my name is Rob Greenlee, and we hope to have you back with us again next week. I'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the WebTalk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same WebTalk Guys time, same WebTalk Guys channel.